So just to begin, just a little bit about me. So I'm with the Public Defenders in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I am their mental health attorney for the misdemeanor division. I also work on felonies. So all of my clients are probably the most difficult clients that the office has, and probably the most difficult people that law enforcement come in contact with. So it's been a very interesting run working with this population and then seeing how everything plays out in court. So what I want to do is kind of give a perspective of what I see when a case comes to me and I know that this client suffers from mental illness, and how I look through the case, how I prepare that case, and how it plays out in court, and also collateral matters that have to deal with the case. So what I want to touch on a little bit is how an officer interacts with people with mental illness and how I might use that information, and I might deliver that to the district attorney or bring it before a judge, and whether it's beneficial or not can severely, significantly impact a case. So I'm going to go into that a little bit. I want to talk about potential avenues to collaborate with public defenders. I know that law enforcement and public defenders are traditionally adversaries, and so there is that natural tension, and it's there for a reason, but there are certain common denominators that I think we can come together on. I've talked to several other public defender offices about this, specifically ones who are law enforcement offices who are involved in Project Echo. I reached out to those public defenders offices to see, what kind of avenues might be open for them to collaborate with law enforcement, like we're doing here in Albuquerque. And then lastly, I want to touch on competency, the laws of competency. So what happens when a defendant is found incompetent, and how that might impact the case at the inception, at the street level, knowing that someone has a long history of incompetency. How does that intersect with community policing? And are there other, ways that we might be able to help people with that kind of history? So let me go ahead and get right into it. So I just kind of want to run down through the basics of what it's like for me. So first, I get evidence, the standard evidence, the lapels, police reports, 911 calls, et cetera. It's turned over to me by the state, and I scrutinize everything. All the attorneys are looking through everything, and we're looking for inconsistencies. So I would just like to keep in mind, and a lot of this might be obvious, but I think it's important to hear it again, that a prosecutor, when they get evidence, they're looking for reasons to justify what happened in the case. The defense attorney is looking for reasons to blow it up. And so that's kind of our job. And then hopefully they come together, justice is served, because if everything falls correctly, then everyone has a fair shake. So that's the general theory behind it. So what I'm looking for, and other attorneys are looking for, is inconsistencies where SOP says XYZ and that did not happen in the case at all, or that did happen. So if I see all the SOPs are followed, I kind of put that aside and move on to the next thing I'm going to scrutinize. And this is just my job, what I have to do. So it's not that I'm trying to point out, all the things that an officer did wrong because I don't like officers. It's just how we're trained as public defenders to look through a case. So once I know that my client suffers from mental illness, there's several questions that loom in my mind. And I ask myself these questions on this slide. Is this officer really trained to handle someone with mental illness? And did they acknowledge it throughout the case investigation? And then did they comply with the SOPs, obviously? I mentioned that before. And did the officer, by disregarding an SOP, kind of create a conflict that otherwise would not have happened? So I say this because all of this, these questions, are tethered to the idea of reasonable officer. And this is a standard that we see in reasonable suspicion, probable cause, and it goes to even the elements of the charge sometimes. So what we do is use the SOPs to determine whether the officer was acting reasonably. So that's why they're so important to us. And so when they pertain to mental health, I'm looking at those extra carefully. And so it's important for, I think, officers to realize that that's what we're using the reasonable standard for, is we're tying them into the SOPs. So let's say I have a client and I see that in the video, SOPs weren't followed for mental health, and this person was just mistreated. I can make that case. Let's say that officer didn't realize that this person suffered from schizophrenia and thought that they were just being belligerent or just because, and didn't realize it was a product of a mental disease or defect. So what I might do is I might talk to the prosecutor and show the prosecutor the videos and say, look, here's what my client suffers from, and here's how my client was treated. And so it may have nothing to do with the merits of the case, the charge, or whatever. But just by the fact of the way that my client's treated, I might be able to gain a dismissal or gain a favorable plea. And so that, I think, is also important to understand, that your interaction with people with mental health diagnosis can impact a case to that degree. It certainly happens on a regular basis. For me, you know, when I see that even if I have an excuse for the client's behavior and the client wasn't mistreated, but I can justify the way that my client acted through their diagnosis, and I can make a case to the prosecutor. The other thing to be aware of is that this is a hot topic in the media. Things do end up in the media. Lapels are sought after by not just me, but also private attorneys. And things happen, like internal affairs, investigations, reprimands, civil complaints. All of these things are used as either leverage, or even a prosecutor might on their own see that, you know what, this case probably isn't worth pursuing because of what happened in the case. The officer didn't follow SOPs. This got media attention. The officer, you know, got some reprimands. This is not going to look good at trial. And so that might be a reason why a DA might dismiss the case or negotiate for a plea. Now, if none of that happens, the other real danger, and also I forgot to mention, if there's anybody has any questions or statements or wants to discuss things, please stop me. I don't mean to just ramble on completely. So
I have a question. Sure. Maybe I'm a simpleton. This is Niels Rosenbaum. When you're talking about who are you defending in these cases, the officers, the civilian, what?
I apologize. So my client would be the one who is arrested and charged with a crime. Okay. So, and if my client suffers from behavioral health, you know, issues, mental health issues, has a significant diagnosis, those are the people I'm defending.
Okay.
Are those people. And then I'm trying to, as part of my job, the function of my job is to defend them, secure the best result I can for them. And so that's why I'm saying that these, the way that an officer might handle a case may incidentally give me leverage to negotiate that has nothing to do with the charge. And so I think it's important that where I see an officer who follows everything by the book, does the SOPs, treats my client with respect, that I have no leverage there. I'm not able to negotiate, because you know what? In that respect, the interests of justice were served to my client. My client was treated fairly. They're treated reasonably according to the officer's training. So when that happens, it really just then goes to the heart of the case, which is where it should be, which is how the system ought to work. It should be focused on the merits of the case, not necessarily what happens incidental to the case. And so that's kind of the goal, I think, of both sides. And I think that is what I'm going to talk about later, is a common denominator between us, is that I would like my clients to be treated fairly. And I think a lot of officers and a lot of victims want to see justice happen in a case. They don't want it to be about the way the client was treated during the case, but they want to see justice done at the end of the day. And I think that's what both sides want in this case. So it's important to, I think, both sides to be focused on that. Now,
I have a question. So this is Niels Rosenbaum again. So just so I'm clear, if you're defending Citizen X who broke into someone's home, let's say, and they're living with a mental illness, they're arrested, they did everything right except for maybe the officer was a little rude or this is a high-profile case or something, you use that rudeness or anything to help negotiate a better deal even if the crime was still the crime?
Exactly. So it's like I said, it may not have anything to do with the case itself, but it has to do with the way my client was treated. And so part of the system, separate part of the case, is that clients have to be treated fairly. And it's the prosecutor's duty to see that defendants are treated fairly. So it ties into their responsibilities, although it may not have anything to do with the example of breaking into a house or something. So that's what I mean. So I apologize if that was a little confusing. But to go back to the last part, let's say I get nowhere with negotiating with a DA, or this case is just going to trial, and I believe that my client was mistreated somehow. Let's say for the officer did not handle a client with mental illness in a way they would had they followed the SOPs. So what I might do is I might present this somehow to a judge and a jury, because that evidence is going to come out somehow, whether it's a lapel or a testimony, it's going to come out, and a judge and a jury are going to see that. And we expect the system to disregard that. So if a client is severely abused, but it has nothing to do with the B&E, a jury and a judge are still going to see that, and it's going to be in the back of their minds, even though we presume or we actually ask them to not put it in the back of their minds. A lot of people might not know whether a judge has a child who suffers from mental illness, the same diagnosis as the defendant, and they see a video of an officer mistreating that person. They might be influenced by that. They might say that they're not biased. A jury might not say that they're biased. But I think if we're all honest and we are consider that those kind of things are hard to erase from people's minds. And I do think, as I've seen in court, that it does influence the way the case plays out in terms of whether there's a finding of innocence, finding of insanity, or whether there's just a dismissal ahead of time for directed verdict or what have you. So I think it's important that even though technically on the books and the law, we say, you know what, that doesn't matter. That's not the evidence that needs to be considered. But if it somehow gets in front of a judge and a jury, I think it's important for us to realize that, you know, it probably will still be there. And I only give this example to show you how far it goes from the officer's conduct on the lapels at the scene at the time of the offense or at the time of the arrest, how far it goes. It can go all the way to a jury, even though it has nothing to do with the case. And so I think it's important for officers who are on the scene to be aware of that, to be conscious that what I'm doing now might end up in front of a jury later. And so it might impact a case, and justice might not be truly done in that case because of people are so concerned with what happened there.
This is Niels Rosenbaum. Sorry, I think this is excellent. That's why I'm asking questions. One, you personally are a specialty court, so you're almost exclusively working with people living with mental illness. Is that correct?
So I do work with specialty courts. So I work with the mental health court, the outreach court, DWI behavioral health court, but I'm also a trial attorney. So I also also take cases where clients are not in a program or a specialty court. I just happen to be their attorney throughout the whole process, throughout the trial. So, yeah, go ahead.
And my other question was, is the inverse of what you're saying true? So if an officer is very kind and respectful and like maybe super polite, does that help the case stick?
Exactly. And, you know, I think I'm just, that might be the next slide.
Oh, sorry.
The slide
just
after
so
that.
Excited.
No, it's in a couple slides, but I will get into that, the inverse. So what I want to say is that what happens behind the scenes is everyone talks. Everyone talks to the judge, prosecutors talk, defense attorneys talk. We all talk about what happened in a case that an officer might not realize. Officer might not realize, oh, I may have done something off the books that's not SOPs, like it was a hot mic or something. We all talk and the judges know it. And that's another thing, is that may not be in trial, but the judges will know it and they'll remember it. Attorneys will remember it. So let's say I have, I see, and I know I'm talking about the negatives, I will go into the positive soon, but if I see an officer who may mistreat my client with mental illness, I might take a note of that officer. And so if I see another case of that officer, I know to look extra carefully at the discovery, at the evidence, because I'm looking for patterns. And at that, and I'm also looking for their internal affairs. Like, has this officer, have people complained about this officer? Because that will be used in court. That will be used in negotiation. And I also think it demerits the department's efforts in mental health training when we see that, because it's cutting against the efforts that the department is making, is when I have to flag a case and see a pattern. So that's something to be aware of. But like I said, the flip side, there are officers who are absolutely exemplary. And the way I see them handle a client with mental illness, just compassionately, fair, even when the, and I'm going to actually provide an example after this soon, is that it goes a long ways. If I know this officer in past cases, I'm not scrutinizing everything. I'm not looking for ways that they messed up, because I trust this officer. I trust that the way they practiced in the past, they're going to do it here. One example of this is, many people might know that it's an officer, say Officer Newbill. You know, we have a saying in our office, and I'm kind of bringing it out here, that if Officer Newbill is mad at your client really messed up. You know, your client did something real bad, you know, if this officer's mad at your client, because we know how compassionate this officer is. We know how patient he is. So we don't scrutinize him. We take him for his word, and we don't put him on the stand so much, because we know that his credibility is intact. And we know he has a, you know, a good, clean, professional record, so we're not digging in there. And we trust him. The people trust him. The community members trust this person. When oftentimes I am working with families, and the families are usually the victims in a case. And it's usually a child or a relative that suffers from mental illness that may have acted out in front of the family, and charges get filed. So the family is very concerned and they reach out to me. When an officer is really kind and compassionate, and even though they made an arrest, that goes a long way with the family, and they see it. And that is the flip side of that too, is that when the family also sees when that doesn't happen. And when we see this kind of trust, you know, like for Officer Newbill's, that validates, it does the opposite, that it validates the department's efforts and all of their training. It shows that it's doing something. And I am happy to say that past few years, that APD especially, we see a drastic change in the way our clients are treated. And it's noticeable. We all know it. And I think that the department's efforts are amazing. And I'm very grateful for it. Our clients are very grateful for it. And the result is that cases are actually being litigated for the issues that ought to be litigated. So we're not so concerned about the way that the client was treated. We're concerned about whether a crime was committed and whether there's a defense or not.
This is Ms. Russell. I'm sorry. I have another. So is it accurate to say that if an officer treats regardless of competency, let's just assume this person living with mental illness is competent. Is it safe to say that an officer treats that person who broke the law with kindness and dignity, they're more likely to get prosecuted for that crime?
to handle a situation. And as a citizen, when I see that, I am like, I really admire it, because I know that if this were my case, if something had, God forbid, something happened to me and I wanted to see justice happen in a case, I would want to see it to the end and not for it to fall through because something blew up between the defendant and the officer on the side. So as a citizen, I appreciate that.
Alex, UNM. So would you be fair to say, as a defense attorney, you're trying to get to the truth, the fairness that best fit the client, as far as, instead of, rather than just winning, quote unquote?
Yes. And that's a difficult thing. I think there's a perception, and I think maybe it's true for some defense attorneys, that they just want to win.
Right.
You know, as a public defender, I don't get to pick my clients. They're given to me. And sometimes I represent people who are guilty. Sometimes I represent people who are innocent. My job, the way I see it, is to make sure that they're given a fair shake at the end of the day. So I'm not here. I mean, some attorneys, I will admittedly say, you know, scorched earth, you know, win at any cost. But I think the heart of my profession as a public defender is not to do that. It's just to see that justice is done on a given case, that my client is treated fairly, that their rights are respected throughout the procedure. And you know what? If all of that happens and at the end of the day they're found guilty, then I don't feel bad, because I know that I did my job. They were given a fair shake and the system played out the way it should have. So that's the way I see it. And in this context, if I see that my client was not treated fairly by the officer, that's objectionable to me. And to me, that I think that needs to go into the prosecutor's decision of whether it's in the interest of justice to pursue this case above what happened in the case itself. So I had a video, I guess there were some technical difficulties into it, but I think we can just describe what happened in the situation and maybe discuss it. And I can point out the things that I think the officer did that were amazing, that I really saw and respected. And I know that if a judge happened to see this video, or a prosecutor happened to see this video, they would admire this officer, and this officer would gain credibility in future cases. So what happened in this case is, the first video that I was going to show is how my client was distressed in the back of a patrol vehicle. The client was shouting obscenities, profanities, just completely aggressive to the officer. And it's in a way that, you know, the officer might be able to interpret this as the defendant's trying to get under the officer's skin. What I know from after the fact is that this was a product of my client's mental illness. So I know that this client is extremely provocative and unbearable. So what I did next is I go through the evidence and I see that this other officer, Officer Lujan, handled this client who was insulting this officer, trying to get under her skin. And what this officer did was she was respectful, did not let this situation, you know, did not let the client succeed in getting under her skin. She almost ignored it, was agnostic about the whole situation. And so she mitigated the belligerent behavior and gained compliance this way respectfully. And I wish I could show it to you so you could see exactly how that this officer did it, how she just completely ignored it, and still maintained that level of respect that the client then later reciprocated. So there's no argument for me that my client was mistreated here. Now, I gave this example. It was a little controversial because of what happened later, is that another officer did not do what Officer Lujan did. And so the client did get under that officer's skin, and it didn't turn out well. And the case went away largely because of that. But not because of what Officer Lujan did, because what she did was exemplary. She shifted attention away from the arrest, so there was no issue. There was a non-issue in the way that she handled it, because she followed SOPs. She treated the client with respect, and she gained the compliance without the client reacting. So, and I don't know if Dr. Rosamond, if you had a chance, so if you had any opinion.
No, I agree that the person was very respectful, kind, and didn't get flustered. So sort of let everything roll off of her back and just sort of stay focused on person's safety and made sure the person was safe. And then when asking them to do things, it was polite, respectful, but with authority. I thought they did it very well.
And so that might just be standard, you know, and you might not see that, you know, in a case how that might play out once it gets to court. But my point here is just that because this officer did everything correctly, we only look at the case then. There's no issue there. There's no discussion about that between me and the prosecutor. And it's actually not helpful for the defense to, like, if I'm looking to win the case, the way the officer handled it doesn't help me. I don't have an argument because my client was treated fairly. So I have to move my defense to what the case is about. So I thought Officer Lujan served as a good example of that. So I want to move on to talk about ways we can collaborate between the public defenders and law enforcement. So I do think that there is an evolving landscape between, you know, increasing awareness of mental health, that we have to adapt to these needs and we have to work together. And we already are in specialty courts. There's specialty officers, CIT, and I'm a mental health attorney. So a lot of these things didn't exist 10 years ago. But now they're there because they're proven effective. One thing I do want to talk about is the specialty courts, law enforcement's involvement in specialty courts. It's actually in a lot of best practices that law enforcement have a seat at the table in specialty court programs. Because it's a way for law enforcement to be involved in the community, to know who's out there. And so they encounter these individuals who are participants in these programs, that they know their history, they know who they are, and they know how to respond effectively. So that way we can help gain some stability in these participants' lives so they don't reoffend. There are a lot of communities out there where crisis intervention officers are actually members of these programs. They attend staffings and they keep a running list of the participants, and they have a say in what happens in the programs, because in a way they're kind of speaking up for the community and their department. So they have input in how we help individuals. And it's a valuable input because when the officers are on the streets, they're seeing these people face to face in the middle of a crisis or a stressful situation. So I think it's important for our officers to get involved in specialty courts. I think I want to reiterate a common denominator that we all have as public defenders and law enforcement. We want to reduce recidivism. We want to connect people to appropriate treatment. And we all want the fair result in court that I was talking about earlier. So I do think that with increased collaboration between our offices, especially through specialty courts, because in specialty courts, it's not supposed to be adversarial. I'm not your adversary in the specialty court. And so we're all there to work together as a team. And that's one way that we address the revolving door dilemma, is that when people just keep cycling in and out of jail, that we can actually stop people and from doing so. And I've seen that. I've seen clients who are picking up charges every week, they get into a specialty court, and then it stops. And then throughout that, their participation in specialty court, there are no charges. So something about the dynamic of a non-adversarial team through the court can reduce recidivism, and I think it's appropriate for law enforcement to be involved in that. So ways to do this. I think it's important if the law enforcement department wants to collaborate with public defenders to find the right person. Because if you go to any other public defender, they might just give you the cold shoulder because of that ingrained animosity that we have in court. So I think if you find an attorney in that office who specializes in mental health, you might have more success because we understand that we can work together to reduce recidivism. One thing that I'm trying to push for that we're somewhat doing here in Albuquerque is kind of sharing information about high utilizers. So let's say I have a client who I see is getting charges every week, and I know why they're getting charges, and I know their mental illness, and I know they've been found incompetent so many times. That information could be valuable to APD. So I might share it with the crisis intervention team to say, hey, can this person be on your list because they're so frequently in crisis, and I see that they're the crisis intervention officer is hardly ever addressing them. Can they be on your radar? And we do that. We share that information, and then all of a sudden, that client stops picking up charges because a specialized officer is handling the unique situation and addressing it in a different way other than filing charges and actually helping this person get the services that they need. And I don't mean to suggest that officers need to be glorified social workers, but it might be a little simple thing of just maybe just transporting someone from point A to point B because charges of criminal trespass will immediately get dismissed because they're incompetent. I'm going to go into that in the last part of my presentation. But I know, for example, you know, the crisis intervention team here, I have one client that they helped get this person into a rehab. So help transport this person to a rehab instead of filing charges. When I know that officer could have, the officer could have filed a number of charges, but she chose not to, instead got this person to rehab, and this person is in a much better place now and is very much more stable than before. So I know another thing that we're doing here in Albuquerque is a diversionary program called LEADS, in which public defenders, APD, and I think BCS, the county, and the DAs are sitting at a table and discussing cases all together before charges are filed. So that's also happening. So that's another way that we're collaborating here in Albuquerque. And I think that's happening also in various other jurisdictions throughout the nation. Again, I talked about this earlier, is participating in specialty courts. A new thing in the National Drug Court Conference happens every year. They just added a law enforcement track, which is specifically to crisis intervention team. And I encourage everyone out there to send some officers to this training to come back. It's extremely valuable. And I don't know if maybe people are already involved in that here. I actually didn't go to the law enforcement training there, but I know that there's a track there. There's a track for defense attorneys, prosecutors, to get you up to speed with the latest research and knowledge of addiction, mental health, and specialty courts.
Where's the next one? Hawaii?
No, the last one was in D.C. I don't know where the next one is, but D.C. was pretty fun.
How would you suggest an officer who's interested in specialty courts get involved?
Reach out to the specialty court judge, reach out to the attorney or the prosecutor who's in that program. So you can ask the district attorney's office, who is the attorney assigned to the specialty court? And open that discussion of, can I sit in on a meeting? Can I be part of the team? Because everything is decided as a team. And I think you could do that through the public defenders, district attorneys, or the courts themselves, and find out who is in this team, connect with them, and get you at the table on the next staffing or whatever. So I want to move on. I don't know where I'm at with time, but hopefully I'm all right. So moving on to competency, I want to talk about what it is briefly, and this may be repetitive. You all might know this already, but I think it's important to refresh to go into how it might intersect with community policing. So this is a very, very old doctrine of competency. It's a fundamental aspect of the law. Someone has to be competent to stand trial in order for them to be convicted, for the case to proceed. It's a violation of due process for someone who's incompetent to stand trial to be prosecuted. So people who are incompetent, who cannot stand trial, they're unable to defend themselves in court, they are actually spend a lot more time in custody than otherwise. Studies have verified this, and only 30% of them are actually found incompetent. So when a defense attorney or the state, so the district attorney, the judge, or a defense attorney can raise the issue of competency, because truly we don't want to put someone through the system who's not really mentally there, who doesn't even know that why they're there, what they're there for, the circumstances of their case, because the law says that that's not fair. So when we have these concerns, they need to get an evaluation, typically just through a board-certified psychologist. Many jurisdictions do it in different ways. In New Mexico, we use board-certified psychologists. So only about 30% of those are actually found incompetent. So we actually believe that people are incompetent because we can't work with them and they don't seem to have any sense of reality, that they're actually still found competent and then proceed through the prosecution. So that means it's a very small percentage of the population entering into the criminal justice system. But they're still there. And they are, by virtue of their incompetency, they have weaker community ties, and they're going to have a long history of hospitalization and probably a lengthy criminal history as well.
I have a question. This is Neil's Rosemont. That's a percentage nationally. What is your experience here? Because my personal experience is that a lot more people who are less incompetent are found incompetent. I knew one guy who had ADHD and was found incompetent. And it was just, in my opinion, not accurate.
it depends. So the issue with competency is it's right here, right now. So is this person competent? When the evaluator is looking at them, are they competent at this moment? So maybe they've been competent in the past, but something happened, they got TBI, whatever. Right now, are they competent? I think that statistic, so I'm the attorney of the competency docket for misdemeanors. So I see all the cases that are referred for competency in misdemeanors, and I agree that that statistic is consistent. I think for misdemeanors...
Here in Albuquerque.
Yes, and I think it's less an issue for felonies because it's quite a lengthy process. It's an expensive process for felonies, and there's a lot more at stake. I think people are more hesitant to raise the issue of competency for felonies than they are for misdemeanors. But what this means, and I've actually used this statistic in my training, training in my office, is that we need to be careful about people who we believe are incompetent because they spend more time in jail, and most of 70% of the time, they're actually found competent. So we need to be careful that we're only referring people that we truly know are incompetent. And I give a special training to the attorneys in my office on how to pick up those signs, because competency is more than just mental illness. You might not have any mental illness whatsoever and still be found incompetent. You might have a whole laundry list of mental health diagnoses and still be found competent, because I'll go into the standard in just a couple slides and you'll see why. So
to add on this, Alex from UNM, also, you know, at times, most of the diagnoses are psychosis and intellectual disability, and especially those with intellectual disability, they might have something called a cloak of competence where they come off agreeable. So you might think they have a general understanding, but at the time of actually doing the interviewing with them, you can understand that they don't understand the court proceedings against them.
Sure. Exactly. I have one other question. Do you feel, does the competency, is it more collaborative now? Because I know the last time I dipped my toe in that water, it did not feel collaborative. And that was probably 6-7 years ago. Are you working with the prosecutors to really only try to get the ones that are, or is it, do you see what I'm asking?
Yes. Yeah, so I think it is more collaborative now in the sense that with the information that my office might have and the prosecutors, we might know, let's say, this person has been found incompetent every year for the last 5 years. Do we need another evaluation? Is anything going to change? Is this person, you know, we use the term here in New Mexico, like MR, you know, so that's still a term that we use here legally. So we have to refer to it. I know it's really outdated, but if we know that that's not going to be cured within a year, so we kind of collaborate to say, you know what, this person doesn't belong in the system because we know they're incompetent. And the reverse, you know, I wouldn't actually.
MR is what used to be, is now called intellectual disability.
Yes, but unfortunately the statute's here.
But just so everybody knows.
So we also might collaborate when the state believes that my client is incompetent, and they're saying, hey, I think I might raise the issue of competency because look at the complaint. Look what happened in this case. Look at them. It doesn't seem like they know what's going on. That I might talk to the DA and say, well, look, I actually do think that they're competent, that they understand what's going on. Here's why. Here's the information that I have, that actually they since this incident, they've engaged in treatment, they're stabilized, what have you. So we do collaborate in that sense. Not all the time. Sometimes we get an evaluation and we have to go to a hearing. The evaluator has to testify, and there has to be a ruling by the judge whether this person's incompetent or not. And so in some ways, especially on the misdemeanor level, we collaborate where someone might be found competent, but we both know this person's really not there. You know, we don't agree with the evaluation. We might work something out that might be fair at the end of the day. So we might negotiate like, well, terms of treatment, terms of probation, et cetera, because we recognize that as people in the courtroom, we're not doctors, but we also know that we have to get through a case somehow. And if a client is found competent that we know can't even sit still for 2 seconds, no one's going to be able to get through this trial. So we got to figure something out. So just on this, I impress upon everyone, you know, in my office that people who are incompetent, they're the most vulnerable. They can't defend themselves. So they might, and whether they're going through the system, they can't defend themselves. I think it's also true at the street level. They're vulnerable to arrest. They're vulnerable because they can't explain or justify what they did, or some instances, I think some of my clients are innocent. You know, they may not have committed the crime, but because they're incompetent, they weren't able to help the officer. They weren't able to help the officer understand what actually happened. And so they can't defend themselves. So they get to this point where they need evaluation, and that's why, you know, deemed not fair to continue with the prosecution. So the standard here is very verbose, and so I kind of make a shorthand of it. So it's basically, I think, if an officer understands this, you know, the shorthand of it, they'll know whether the likelihood of how this is going to play out in court. Does this person have a factual understanding of the case? Do they know what happened here? And can they articulate it? And even if they do articulate it, does it make sense? Is it rational? And do they seem to have the ability? We use the term capacity rather than ability. And I think those two words can get confused depending on the evaluator, to assist in their own defense and understand why they're being prosecuted. If they lack that capacity, then they're not competent. Now, I make the distinction between ability and capacity because one thing that we talk about in terms of the evaluation with the evaluator and in court is this a situation where the client can help or they won't help their attorney? So do they have the ability to help me? They're just choosing not to? Or do they genuinely lack the capacity whatsoever to help me? So we make that distinction between can versus won't. And so that's also a distinction I think an officer can make on scene. Is this seemingly knowing what I know about this person through my investigation or what I see at the scene, does it seem that this person is refusing to cooperate with me, or do they lack the capacity to cooperate with me? Because that will go directly to the third element, is whether they have the capacity to assist their attorney. So this is where we start getting into what happens after they're found incompetent. So many different things can happen depending on the charge and the jurisdiction and the available treatment. In Albuquerque, misdemeanors, if they're found incompetent, they're just dismissed. Now, the DA always has the option to pursue civil commitment if someone poses a danger, immediate danger to themselves or others. They can be committed for, you know, residential treatment, or it can be outpatient commitment as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be residential, but they don't do that for misdemeanors. That's very resource intensive, and it's would consume the office, you know, the district attorney's office, if they had to pursue civil commitment for misdemeanors. So they're dismissed here, and I understand that other jurisdictions have options. You know, they might be able to take them to a hospital, you know, divert completely, you know, from other from charges in the first place. They and I don't know, I was talking to another public defender yesterday and in Portland, how they have a different, like a whole host of options that an officer can choose from instead of pursuing charges in the first place or even after the fact that someone's found incompetent. We do things, so for felonies, that's a whole different ballgame. Felonies, certain felonies that are deemed dangerous can require, if someone is found incompetent, can require someone to be committed at the state hospital. This is common. Probably almost every jurisdiction, I believe, probably has a statute similar to New Mexico's where if it's a certain enumerated crime that they're charged with and they're found incompetent, there's clear and convincing evidence that the charges probably would have been proven at trial, and they fall in one of these crimes, they're incompetent, they're committed to a state hospital for a term of
90 days.
Yeah. Sometimes it could be 3 years. It could be a long time until they attain competency. So the treatment to competency is another thing. Is someone's found incompetent, the DA can pursue treatment to competency. So they go to the state hospital and they're treated to the point where an evaluator determines that they are now able to stand trial. And then the prosecution can commence. A lot of the times, the district attorneys, since that takes so long, most of the time, the district attorneys say, you know what, let's plea it and close it out because they were treated to their term of the jurisdiction anyways. So that would be the punishment, was them staying at the state hospital and doing all this treatment. Let's call it a day.
Is that, that's where John Hyde has been. John, yes.
Sorry, I don't.
It's okay.
That may have been a big case, but sorry.
No,
not involved with that one. So civil commitment is, so like I said, whether it's misdemeanor, felony, whatever, if it's dismissed, a DA can pursue civil residential commitment. And that would be a petition that the DA has to follow through. This is also typical of most jurisdictions. Some jurisdictions, the officer can be the petitioner to a court to file for civil commitment. And like I said, in New Mexico and actually many other states, they have what's called assisted outpatient treatment. This is a very new thing for Albuquerque, where it's after a finding of incompetency, it can go before a district court judge who can mandate outpatient treatment. And this is actually being kicked off, and I have a few clients, and this is actually working out really well in Albuquerque so far. Other jurisdictions have experienced that this has been, AOT has been flooded in a lot of jurisdictions to where there's a huge waiting list because it's been so effective, because it's court-ordered instant treatment. So a lot of people who are even outside the criminal justice system have flooded assisted outpatient treatment in their jurisdictions. But in Albuquerque, it's fairly new, and I'm not sure what it's like in your jurisdiction, but it's a very good program if it's here, if you have it.
Ben Wendrus with APD. What happens if someone's charged with one of the crimes that fits that dangerous felony? I think there's three here in Mexico. And they cannot be treated to competency, but the state is confident they could prove their case. What happens to that person?
So if they cannot be treated to competency, I think they stay at they can stay in the state hospital for a term necessary. So what it could be for the term of the jurisdiction behind the charge itself in New Mexico. But if this person is showing progress, or if it's been a certain amount of time, the DA has to follow up with this after every few, I think it's every 3 months or 9 months. It can depend on how a judge orders it. But they have to follow, the DA has to follow up with this case to see how is this person doing at the state hospital, because we can't just keep them there forever. So if they're showing improvement, or if they're not showing improvement, then they continue on for the jurisdiction. If they are, then we might have to, and this goes into, this is a treatment to competency issue. So if they're deemed now they're competent after this length of treatment, then the prosecutor will decide, do we bring this to trial or do we resolve this case somehow? So why does this matter? And it's, so I want to talk about community policing, because nationwide community policing is expanding. It's blowing up. So many jurisdictions are utilizing it. So some of the main tenets, the three main tenets of community policing are citizen input, broad police function, and personal service. So this means that you're hearing from the community, you're doing more than just fighting crime, and you're not doing, you're tailoring your practice, you know, specific to that community and to the situation. So those are big, the three main tenets of community policing. So I think that knowing people in your community who have the history of incompetency is knowing your community. You know that they're out there and you know what might happen. And I encourage people in other jurisdictions to find out what happens to these people in your jurisdiction should they be found incompetent, because it, like I said, it differs widely. So knowing what would happen if charges were filed, and you might consider alternatives. And this plays into your discretion as an officer on what to do in the situation, having this knowledge in the back of your mind. So like if it's a dangerous felony for certain, you might be expecting what, you know, would be happening if they, should they be found incompetent. The other side of that is if someone is incompetent, they've been found incompetent so many times, and these are petty misdemeanors, jaywalking, criminal trespassing, you might expect that, well, if I book this person, they're just going to be released and the case is dismissed tomorrow, and we're going to be back here doing the same thing again and again and again. So it might not be worth your time to do that, because in your discretion, you might decide, well, this isn't going to help me, it's not going to help the community, and it's not going to help this person. So this is my last slide, but let me go back for this for a second. One alternative that you might consider, like I said earlier, I get involved with families, because a lot of my clients are picking up charges that involve their families, or they're not, and their families are just gravely concerned about what's happening to their family member. So one of them, you know, for example, would have liked to express to me that she would have liked to know that this person was getting arrested, because she could have helped. She could have helped divert this person, you know, to their hospital, or take this person to their home, or avoid the whole situation altogether. So I have a client who carries around contact information of his family member because he doesn't have a sense of like how to articulate this to people. So he has a card. And the card is like, contact your family, you know, these people in case of emergency. So in this situation, you might know, well, this person's been found incompetent. If I book them, you know, for criminal trespass or some other misdemeanor, they're just going to be released. You find this card on them. You might decide, well, let me call this person and see what's going on. Let me find out more about this person. What can we do to help get this person off the streets? Because booking them isn't gonna cut it. So that might be an example of an officer using their discretion and using the tenets of community policing to tailor their response to the situation in a way that might be more productive.
Can I ask a question real quick? Sure. Detective Spade with APD. So I agreed with a lot of what you're talking about, the community policing, and that sometimes you may not be serving them if you're arresting them for like criminal trespass. But are you forgetting that part of community policing is the victims themselves, people that are citizens are calling to say that this person is trespassing there? And so if we go there, what are you guys doing to help keep that from reoccurring? Because you're part of the process. So to exclude yourself from that part of the process doesn't seem fair, because we're the ones that are going to keep going out there. And we're the ones now in community meetings that are having to answer to the community as to, why didn't you arrest that person? Why is this person still here? So I think maybe, can you address that?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. I think that point is absolutely valid. And we do have a place in that. I totally agree. Some officers have actually reached out to me about specific people who they didn't charge. And they said, what can you do for this person? I keep coming out for this person. I don't want to charge them, but something's got to happen. They're tearing up the neighborhood. Can your office do something?
What do you guys do?
Well, we have a social work division, so we can help get this person services. We can help get them housing, help make referrals to certain places. So we help try to connect them the best that we can if they're a client or they're a frequent flyer. So maybe their case was dismissed, but we know they're going to get charges again. We try to stop it. So that's another alternative that I would suggest, going back to the collaboration piece, is to reach out to the public defenders about frequent flyers that we may not realize, because a lot of the information, I think it goes both ways. I see, I talk to officers who tell me more about what's going on with my client that I had no idea. I have no idea what was going on in the community because all I see is the police report from this incident. So I don't know that there's all these other factors in place that enforced reinforced the officer's decision to make this arrest on this particular situation instead of doing it 15 instances before. Right. So knowing that information, I'm able to confront my client with that to say, what do we need to do to fix this? And I'm in the position to talk to my client that because I can advise him the legal consequences of should this happen again. And maybe it's an issue of just getting a shot. Maybe they suffer from schizophrenia and they just haven't had their shot in so long that they've decompensated and they need help getting that shot. Well, I can call a social worker to come down, meet with this person and try to connect them to something. I've had success with that. On the other side of it, I see clients where I think officers may not know what's going on. I see this client has this whole history. I know so much about them. And the officer making arrest might not understand the whole background of this person. And so they might not know this person. All this person needed to do was just say, walk down the street with me, and then situation over. But without that background knowledge that the officer didn't have, the officer shouldn't be blamed for not knowing that. So I think that's more of a collaborative piece of like I said, me reaching out to some people in the CIT and say, hey, is this person on your radar? Because here's the situation with this person. They could, avoid prosecution in many ways if the situation were addressed in this manner. And so sharing that information to law enforcement can help that client. But then, like I said, the reverse. So if an officer has all this background, gets it to me, I'm able to use that as best as I can to help. I can't make miracles.
And are you the contact person for this to go through the social worker, or is there say we have, as CIU detectives, we have someone that's been arrested that many times, and a lot of times if we wait for it to get to court like that, it's just going to be lost. Whereas who is the contact that our detectives can reach out to at the public defender's office to set that in motion, which you just talked about?
I would say if it's a misdemeanor,
me.
I think you could reach out to a managing attorney. Who's a managing attorney in this in the division? Your officer can find that out and say, who can talk to me about this person? And then they can point you to the right attorney.
Are they going to be as open to talking to us because you talked about that adversarial relationship? Are they going to be open to talking to people when they call them?
And I think there's still, I agree, there's still that tension, but there's also, I'm a public defender. I'm open. So I'm open to it. Other attorneys are open to it. I think we all, like I said, there's that common denominator. We don't want charges. We don't want people to reoffend, and we want to get them off the streets, get them the help that they need. We all want that. So that's one thing we can all agree on, that we can work there. Now, if there's active litigation, if there's charges and it's about this case and it goes to that case specifically, you might be a witness to something. There may be limitations, but I think generally, if it's an issue of how can we help this person? I don't imagine, and maybe there are attorneys, certainly there will be attorneys who are completely opposed to talking with law enforcement. But I think there's a great number of them out there who would be open to it. I certainly am. And talking with some public defender's offices, with law enforcement who are with Project Echo, asking them, for instance, I asked the Portland PDs, would you be open to kind of opening a dialogue between law enforcement and you on the way that I'm trying to pursue it in Albuquerque? And the answer is yes, and in other jurisdictions as well. So I do think it's something worth exploring, and I think that the trends, and I think it's going to get there eventually, because we're going to have to address this rise in awareness of mental health and substance use somehow. And I think it's going to require some base level collaboration.
There's a question from the network. A sergeant here at APD says, does your office ever attend neighborhood association meetings and provide this side with the community? I think it would be a great idea to attend these meetings with local officers.
I've suggested to a few people to attend the community policing councils. I'm board member of MRAC, Mental Health Response Advisory Committee here. So I'm involved in that. So is Dr. Rosenwald. So
yes.
We're there together. I do think that it should be encouraged on public defenders should attend these meetings to foster some more collaboration. And I do think, I don't mean to suggest in this presentation that the onus ought to be exclusively on law enforcement. If I was giving this presentation to public defenders, I would say, you all need to be out there in the community talking to law enforcement and opening the dialogue and attending these meetings as well. So I hope you don't mean, take from me to suggest, hey, it's all on you, law enforcement, make things right. You know, I don't mean to say that because I think you're doing a lot of good work out there. I do think public defenders and defense attorneys should be more involved in the community to address these lying issues because at the end of the day, it benefits our clients. It benefits my clients to help reduce like the likelihood of getting them charges by working with law enforcement to get them services. It helps them. So part of my concern is I don't want to see this client back, you know, in court again and again and again. I want it to stop, and I'm going to need the help of law enforcement. So I think public defenders ought to be seeking ways to collaborate. But also at the same time, I think that there needs to be a healthy respect for the function of public defenders. We're there to be against the grain. We're there to question and to scrutinize to make sure that everything was done correctly and fairly. So that function, I think, needs to remain in place. But I do think there's just that little bit of room for collaboration that can be more exploited.
Thank you.
Yeah, excellent.
So that's all I have. If you have any questions, anyone has any other questions.